programming support comes from the Side Door Jazz Club at the historic Old Lyme Inn, presenting live jazz every weekend in an intimate listening room with a full bar and relaxed ambience. In addition to the jazz club, the Old Lyme Inn offers fine dining, overnight stays, and weekend getaways. Full calendar and ticket information at thesidedoorjazz.com or by phone at 860-434-0886.
And we are listener-supported community radio. We are WPKN, and we are in Bridgeport, Connecticut, 89.5 FM. Thank you, Rod Richardson. And thank you, Side Door Jazz. And you just heard Kenny Burrell there with Saturday Night Blues. I think some of you know, Lisa Sahulka with you, I'm here till 4. I think some of you know that at one point in my career, I worked at Southern Poverty Law Center, and I have a lot of interest in the work that they do there, particularly around the Intelligence Project, white supremacy research, hate speech research, things like that. And I've maintained that interest since I've left Montgomery, Alabama. And so every once in a while, I love to bring Mark Potok, who was a director at Southern Poverty Law Center, recently left the organization and has been doing a lot of interesting speaking engagements and things like that. I love to bring him all the way from Montgomery, Alabama to you in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So I'm about to introduce Mark Potok. Mark, how are you?
I am great. Thanks so much for having me.
It is so good to hear your voice. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I mean, the world is falling down around our ears, but, you know, personally, all's well.
You know, the first question I want to ask is, you have a new mayor in Montgomery, which seems kind of amazing to me as an outsider, but you've lived there your whole life. How amazing is that?
Well, not quite my whole life, but I've been here for about 22 years. And, you know, yes, Montgomery just elected Stephen Reed, who is the first black mayor of Montgomery in, you know, 200 years. So in Montgomery, surprisingly enough, despite being, in a sense, the cradle of the civil rights movement, is really the very last major southern city to have no black mayor in its history. And now that's over. So it was quite a moment. You know, very much celebrated down here. There was an initial battle between about 10 different contenders, but in the end, it was between Stephen Reed and a white guy who owns a television station down here. And the white guy was whipped. It was about 74-75% for Stephen Reed, who comes out of an old and well-known black family here in Montgomery.
And do you think that that bodes well for a change in how people are thinking in Montgomery, or do you think that was kind of a fluke?
No, I don't think it's a fluke at all. I mean, much has changed down here. The city in the 20-some years I've been down here has really been transformed from a kind of terrible little backwater, half-dead southern town, into quite a bustling, and reasonably cosmopolitan southern city. Really, the biggest thing that's happened in the last year or two has been the opening of the lynching memorial, which was erected by the Equal Justice Initiative and its leader, Brian Stevenson. That's been really remarkable. The lynching memorial, maybe counterintuitively, has been a huge tourist draw. We've gotten about 600,000 visitors in the last year since it opened, you know, above and beyond the people that Montgomery gets anyway. So the city is moving forward, I think, in real ways. We'll see how Stephen Reed does, what kind of opposition he meets. But, at this point, things look pretty good for us.
Do you think the Trump administration and their general take on the universe, right, does that lead to people wanting to, you know, go to a lynching museum? Do you think that's where that interest is coming from? Do you think it's an interest in civil rights that's emerging? Do you think it was always there, but there wasn't a lynching museum to go to? What is it?
Well, Trump does have something to do with it. It's pretty well known that a lot of organizations like the SPLC, like the ACLU, that are seen as being generally on the left, essentially got a huge Trump dividend in the sense that right after Trump was elected in the 2.5 years since then, 3 years almost, these organizations have gotten far more donations than ever before. So that's been a part of it. I should also say that a whole lot of the visitors have been African Americans from other parts of the country, typically from the North. So, you know, as so many African American families really originated in the South, these are people whose, you know, grandparents perhaps moved up north and who are coming back to the South, often for the very first time, to see the Civil Rights Memorial, to see the lynching memorial. There are a number of different things in the city and around us that are really, you know, that are strong reminders and commemorations of the Civil Rights Movement. So, you know, we're seeing basically a boom in civil rights tourism.
And I have to imagine, when I left Southern Poverty, the fund balance there was around $350 million. I can only imagine what the organization is sitting on now. Do you have any idea what it is?
They're pushing half a billion. The rise of this kind of ethnic nationalism, this kind of racist nationalism, you know, right-wing populism, whatever you want to call it, that we've seen. So, no, I don't think it's surprising. You know, what I'm talking about, just to try and be specific, and what I tried to lay out in my London speech, was that, you know, people who say, as the lieutenant governor of Texas said after the El Paso massacre, that the radical right, these things are caused by people watching violent video games, for example, is absurd. Right. And we hear it all from Trump, from Fox News, that it's, you know, it's violent video games, that these are people smoking too much marijuana, you know, that it's just a question of mental illness. And, you know, if only we had enough shrinks out there, we could solve the problem, you know, or that it's Russian bots on the Internet or algorithms that FaceNet has wickedly put up. You know, these things all may have some minor effect. But, you know, what is going on is the product of huge historical forces. And what I'm talking about is globalization and all of its effects. You know, demographically, the most obvious, to speak about the United States only right now, is the change in the racial in the racial numbers, the idea that whites will lose their majority in the United States by about 2043, 2044, very soon, in other words. So, you know, there's an enormous reaction to that in some quarters of the country, white people who feel like, you know, this is not my country. The country my forefathers, my Christian white forefathers built, has been taken from me, that kind of thing. On a financial front, on an economic front, there are huge sectors of the economy, of our economy, just like many European countries, that are suffering. You don't hear much about them in the news, but, you know, ask somebody who used to work in a textile plant or at a steelworks or at an auto factory. These people are in trouble, and not much is being done for them. So there's also quite a lot of economic anger, rage out there. And finally, I would say yet another effect of globalization are the immense cultural changes we're seeing in our country and in the Western world in general. You know, the best example of which may be same-sex marriage, right? Something that seemed to most people unimaginable, whether you thought it was good, bad, or indifferent 20 years ago, and which is now the law of the land in all 50 states. So what I'm trying to suggest is that, you know, when society, what I talked a lot about in the London speech, was making a kind of comparison to what's happening now in the United States to what happened in this country in the 1920s, which was another time of very great and kind of fundamental change, which produced a real backlash, which in turn led to the growth of the largest Ku Klux Klan in our history, some 4 million members by about 1925. And ultimately resulted in something very awful, which was the 1924 Immigration Act, the imposition of a racial quota system on the United States that essentially made it impossible for non-white people and people who weren't from Northern Europe to immigrate to this country.
And when you're standing at the podium in the UK looking at that audience, which I'm assuming had a lot of people that were dealing with Brexit sitting there, are you thinking that that is the same thing that we're dealing with, or it's kind of a parallel but not exactly a Venn diagram of that?
Well, it's a very, very close parallel, if it's not precisely the same thing. And what I mean is that if you look at the demographics of who voted for Trump and think about some of the reasons why, and then look at the demographic of who voted for Brexit and why, you'll see that they really are the same people. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, in England, much of the pro-Brexit vote came from the north counties, which are poor, relatively poor, post-industrial counties, areas that used to be very big in heavy industry and manufacturing. But, you know, most of those jobs have now traveled elsewhere in the world. Similarly here, of course, we had voters in places like Michigan, you know, who much to the shock of many people, because they'd voted for Democrats for so many decades, voted for Trump for very much the same reasons. You know, this isn't our country anymore. We need to take it back. And, of course, Trump fueled that, both, you know, in his campaign, you know, talking about rapist invaders from Mexico and, you know, scary Muslims and all the rest of it. So, you know, Trump was able to both, Trump really, in effect, both reflected this change, the growth of the radical right, and fueled it and amplified it.
So let me ask you, let's say, and I know this is virtually the most unlikely outcome possible, but let's say that Andrew Yang got elected. Okay, and every American gets this $1,000 per month that he's talking about, right? Do you think then that the population of white supremacists would go down in the United States, and if so, how much?
I mean, that really is sort of a rank speculation question. But, you know, I don't think, look, I don't think $1,000 per month, you know, for everybody in the United States solves the problem. It leaves, if you even think of it as a problem, solves the dilemma. You know, if you say to me, Lisa, something I really hate, I guess that's hate speech. But, you know, so what I'm trying to say is that there is no law that says, you know, a certain kind of speech is hate speech and therefore illegal. Obviously, that would contravene the First Amendment. You know, so there are, of course, in Europe, there are different legal systems, and there are different legal concepts, the biggest one being, relevant to this conversation, the idea of group defamation. That, you know, in the United States, you know, individuals can defame or libel each other, one another, slander one another, but you can't be, you can't go to court, you can't lose even in a civil action based on group defamation. So I can say, you know, all the Chinese are this, all the Jews are that, all white people are the other thing, and say really anything I like, including they should all die, and that's completely protected by the First Amendment. In Europe, however, in a great many of the European legal systems, as I say, there is this concept of group defamation. You know, in a place like Germany, you can be sent to prison for making those kinds of statements. So, but you know, I think often hate speech is used just as shorthand here in a kind of sloppy way to say, you know, ugly speech, speech defamatory of groups of people and so on. But as I say, it's very, very soft and really doesn't have any hard meaning.
And I want to thank you so much for joining us. And the last question I have is, are you going to be speaking anywhere in the Northeast where some of our listeners could come and hear you speak?
No, not at the moment. I grew up in Vermont, and I seem to get invited up there from time to time. But at the moment, I have nothing on my schedule, so but I would love to do it. So I just have to wait and see if something comes up.
Well, do let us know, and I owe you a martini coming up soon.
That I look forward to with gusto.
Very good. So we'll see you then, and thank you again, Mark Potok. And we are listener-supported community radio, WPKN 221 on a Tuesday. Lisa Sahulko with you until 4. And this is Jerry Mulligan.